Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to Saturday, Do Me Who Makes a Welcome Return to the Sydney Institute. He's spoken here in person on two previous occasions, and today virtually. We're very grateful for his appearance today, and I'll introduce him briefly. Saradan Dumay, he writes a bi-weekly column for the Wall Street Journal, mainly on India and South Asia, but sometimes on other topics as well. He's a resident fellow of the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and previously worked in the New Delhi as the New Delhi Bureau Chief for the Far Eastern Economic Review and as Indonesian correspondent for the Far Eastern Economic Review and the Wall Street Journal Asia. He's published a book, My Friend and Fanatic, Travels with a Radical Islamist, which I recall reading about a decade ago, and he's currently working on a book on Prime Minister Modi. And he's been educated at the University of Delhi, Princeton and Columbia University. And today our speaker's going to speak on the topic of India and Pakistan after the return of the Taliban. And what we'll do is we'll hear from our speaker about 20, 25 minutes. We'll take questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than the top of the hour. Senator Dan, off you go. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard and Anne, for having me. And thank you all of you for tuning into this. As Gerard was saying, I've spoken twice before at the Sydney Institute. And quite frankly, I would much rather be there in person right now than doing this on Zoom. But I'm very happy to see that the Sydney Institute has adapted well to these trying times, and look forward to joining all of you in person once we're on the other end of this pandemic. So I'm going to keep my comments today relatively brief, and I really look forward to having a good discussion with you. In the past, one of the most enjoyable things for me about speaking at the Sydney Institute has been just the quality of the conversation that the Institute fosters. So let me just start by, I'll divide it broadly into two parts, and these are sort of what I think the return of the, what the implications of the return of the Taliban are for India. Then from there, I'll talk a little bit about what I think the implications are for Pakistan. I'm going to focus mostly on what I think are likely domestic outcomes, but I will touch upon some of the foreign policy implications also, but perhaps we can go into those a little bit more deeply in the Q&A. So starting with India, I think the way to look, the way that the return of the Taliban is viewed overwhelmingly, I would say, by strategic thinkers in New Delhi is through the prism of the 1990s. And that was, of course, not a very happy period in Afghanistan, but it was also not a happy period for India. As many of you recall, after the Mujahideen defeated the Soviets in 1989, a lot of the jihadist groups that had been operating or that had been born in Pakistan under the aegis of the Inter-Services Intelligence, the Pakistan Army's intelligence agency, they pivoted their attention toward the state of Jammu and Kashmir, which was India's only Muslim majority province. Of course, they were helped along by local unrest and the fact that the Indian authorities 2 years earlier in 1987 had conducted an election, which was widely regarded as a sham. It was rigged. So there was an uptick of violence. And in fact, when we look back on the insurgency in Jammu and Kashmir, it is dated to 1989, and that is no coincidence. So that is sort of the prism through which Indians view it. There was, of course, the notorious hijacking of an Indian Airlines aircraft in 1999. Some of you may remember It was hijacked to Taliban-controlled Kandahar. In return for freeing the passengers, India agreed to free three people who were in its jails on terrorism incidents. One of them ended up founding the group Jaish-e-Mohammed. Another one ended up being responsible for the murder of the Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. So in many ways, the sweeping in to power of the return of the Taliban, coincidentally on India's Independence Day on August 15th, is probably the worst possible nightmare for India in the Afghan context. The Indians have spent 20 years trying to claw back a foothold in Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban. India had emerged as the fifth largest donor to Afghanistan. It had paid for a new Afghan parliament. It had sent Indian teachers, doctors, and so on. It had very close ties with the Afghan government. It donated helicopters to the military. It helped train police officers. The military footprint was extremely light or virtually non-existent, partly because NATO and the US did not want India to get involved too deeply in that arena to keep Pakistan sensitivities in mind. And also because I think Indians themselves realized that was not what they would be able to do politically. But short of a sort of, a military presence, the Indian presence in Afghanistan was quite deep. They had four consulates and a large embassy in Kabul. And now all of that has essentially evaporated overnight. And they find that the Taliban, which in New Delhi is widely viewed as a proxy essentially of Pakistan, because it was not only born in Pakistan originally in the early 1990s, but also through after 2001, it found safety and sanctuaries in Pakistan. And in fact, the defeat of the United States and NATO in Afghanistan would not have been possible without those sanctuaries in Pakistan. So it's a clear strategic setback for India. It is viewed largely through the prism of the late 1990s, which was an unhappy period. Now, one of the major sort of strategic questions that emerges from this is, to what extent is this going to affect Indian security? And how is that going to end up affecting India's own stance in the larger region? And this goes back to a very old dilemma in Indian strategic thought, or even in British Indian strategic thought to an extent, where you talk about in an Indian context, the dilemma between the continental question and the maritime question. And in our present day terms, very simply put, the question really is whether India is going to focus its energies, focus its defense preparedness on its land borders, primarily with Pakistan, but also with China, or will it be able to find the resources, but also to sort of reorient its own thinking and vision towards maritime questions, which of course is what people in Washington would like to see. An India that looks eastward more and is less obsessed with what is happening on its western borders. The return of the Taliban throws all of that into question, particularly if there is an uptick of violence. We're already seeing an uptick of violence in Jammu and Kashmir, but particularly if we see some of that Islamist violence spill over, either we see dramatic incidents in Jammu and Kashmir itself, like the 2019 suicide bombing that led to Indian airstrikes in Pakistan, or we see dramatic incidents in other parts of India, such as the Mumbai attacks, which were carried out by the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a Pakistan-based group. So that, I think, is the sort of big question. Can India manage to contain what the blowback from this, from the fall of Kabul, from the fall of Afghanistan to the Taliban in terms of its own security and what that does to its strategic posture? Domestically, I'd say very briefly that this also plays into in some ways, some pretty dangerous trends. If you, for example, followed the coverage of the fall of the of of Kabul and the coverage of Afghanistan in many Indian news channels, particularly the Hindi news channels that are viewed as very close to the ruling party, the BJP, I would say irresponsible would be a bit of an understatement. They generally were very quick to conflate the Taliban with all Muslims, and therefore by proxy conflate the Taliban with Indian Muslims. So the fact of that they were tempted to, and in fact used the incidents in Afghanistan as a means to demonize Indian Muslims, I think sort of deepen some of those fissures that we've already seen emerge, particularly over the last 7 years, as the ruling party mobilizes its base, and it mobilizes its base among the 80% of the population that is Hindu, in large degree by mobilizing them against the threat, as they see it, of the Muslim minority. This is not to say that there is no genuine security threat that India faces from radical Islamist terrorism. There is a genuine threat, but there is a tendency also to not be very careful and not to separate the part of the threat that is genuine from the concerns and the realities of India having a very large Muslim population, which is in fact overwhelmingly peaceful and has nothing to do with any kind of violence or radicalism. So that's kind of the, you know, my top line view of what we're going to, of how things are different from, let's say, if we'd had this conversation a year ago. On the Pakistan side, we have seen that this is undoubtedly a short-term win for Pakistan. The ISI has had this dream, the Pakistani army has had this dream of strategic depth, which in a nutshell was the idea that because Pakistan was much smaller than India geographically, Afghanistan would kind of give it space where it could counter India's geographical advantage by kind of having this space in the rear to which it could withdraw. And so Pakistan has, you know, for 4 decades now, it has worked very hard to have an Afghan government that many Indians and Afghans would say that the Pakistanis want essentially a vassal state, a colony in Afghanistan. The Pakistanis themselves would put it more mildly, and they would say that they want a friendly government in Kabul. But either way, the Pakistanis want a government in Kabul which would be very sympathetic to their concerns about India, and would most definitely not in any way be seen as tilting towards India and against Pakistan the way the previous government, the Ghani government, was seen, was viewed in Islamabad. So undoubtedly a short-term win. In many ways, they have been more successful this time around than they were even in the previous period when they swept into Kabul in 1996 and ruled for 5 years. And the key difference is that this time the Taliban, the way they went about it, they captured some of the northern areas, the places with borders with Iran, Tajikistan, and the other stans. They captured those areas first, which means that there really isn't a base for the resistance the way there was in the late 1990s when Ahmad Shah Massoud and others held out in the Panjshir. In those days they had land routes to Tajikistan; they could be supplied. Now, at this moment at least, there is no resistance to speak of to the Taliban, unlike what we had seen in the 1990s. For Pakistan, I would say that the long-term prognosis, though, I don't think is very good. And the thing that I find most intriguing, in fact, is not something that has been covered much, but it's the idea of how the return of the Taliban affects a much deeper debate about the shape of Islam in South Asia. This debate really goes back to more than 150 years. And, you know, since it's always nice to speak with an Australian audience that is familiar with some of this stuff when I speak with American audiences. It's a little bit more unfamiliar. But many of you would be aware that in 1857, there was what was known as the mutiny in British India, where the British put down quite firmly and violently revolt against the East India Company. And in the aftermath of that, there was a lot of soul searching among the Muslim elites of northern India, because they had been thoroughly vanquished by English military power. And essentially what you saw was a division where, I'm simplifying over here, but it's oversimplified, but nonetheless accurate, where there were basically two contending views that emerged in their sort of in their purest form. They were named after two competing towns in northern India, Deoband and Aligarh. Deoband stood for the idea that the response to Western political and military superiority was to shun the West, shun Western ideas, and return to scripture, return to the life of the Prophet, the Quran and the Sunnah, the Quran and the life of the Prophet for guidance. And from that comes the school of Islam called Deobandism. It's a cousin of Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, with which many people are familiar. It's essentially a back to basics ideology. The Taliban is the most extreme interpretation of Deobandism. It is a version of Deobandism that they practice. Therefore, it should come as no surprise, for instance, that they are hostile to music. They are hostile to any kind of syncretic religious influences. They're very hostile to the Shia. And that's one of the reasons why they go after the Hazara. And in fact, that also goes back to the dynamics of late 19th century India, where some Sunni clerics felt that Shia Islam had been gaining too much power. So that's the first sort of response to the after the mutiny, that was Deobandism. The Deoband Madrasa was founded in 1867, so 10 years after the mutiny. Another 10 years later, in 1877, there was marked the founding of the Aligarh Muslim University, now known as Aligarh Muslim University, originally known as the Anglo-Mohammedan College. This was founded by the premier reformist of the British Raj, a man called Sir Syed Ahmed Khan. And in a nutshell, without getting too deep into the details, his argument was just the opposite of the Deobandis. Now, this was not a secularist. This was not a person who was talking about abandoning Islam or watering it down, but he believed that Muslim elites in India needed to embrace Western mores and education, including science and literature. So in Deoband, you had a group of people who were essentially sitting under a pomegranate tree and memorizing the Quran and learning about the Hadith and traditional scholarship. In Aligarh, you had another group of Muslims who were reading Macaulay and Shakespeare and how to use a knife and fork and so on. And that has been really there's been this sort of tension between the Aligarh approach and the Deoband approach for 150 years. Of course, in real life, in many people, you know, people could be a mix of both. It doesn't have to sort of take the pure form that I've described. But nonetheless, the victory of the Taliban in Afghanistan is a victory of Deobandism. And I believe it's going to strengthen Deobandi forces in Pakistan. And there are going to be people who ask the same questions that the Taliban asked. Why do we need to be ruled by an elite who seem out of touch to us, who seem more westernized, who are much more westernized than us, whose daughters go unaccompanied to parties or to foreign lands, people who sip scotch in the evenings at home, and so on. And so some of that anger and resentment, and some of the idea that the solution really lies in going back and becoming, in their view, better Muslims, I think those energies have always been alive in Pakistan. And here the victory of the Taliban really boosts them. The other sort of big question for Pakistan, I think, going ahead is going to be the Pashtun question. The Pashtuns, as you know, are an ethnic group that straddles both Pakistan and Afghanistan. There are more Pashtuns in Pakistan than in Afghanistan. And in fact, the Pakistani backing for the Taliban and before that for the Mujahideen really goes back to what they viewed as the proclivities of the Pashtuns towards independence. In the run-up to partition in 1947, the partition of India and Pakistan, the Pashtuns had not voted for Pakistan. The Pashtuns were their tallest leader, Mamand Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, was a follower of Mahatma Gandhi. The Afghans did not famously recognize the border after at independence. And there was a feeling in Pakistan that the best way to counter the Pashtun question or Pashtun nationalism was to play up Islamism or Islamic fundamentalism. And that from that, you get the sort of support for groups that were fundamentalist among the Pashtuns, the Mujahideen in the 1980s, and then the Taliban starting in the 1990s. So on the surface, you could argue that the Taliban coming to power may in fact have settled this question in a way that the Pakistani military would like to see it settled. But I think that this thing, things, you know, tend to be much more complicated. And the thing that I would that would concern me and that would keep me awake if I were a general in the Pakistan army with some foresight and some knowledge of history would be that what if the Taliban, who are undoubtedly Islamic fundamentalists, decide that instead of being Islamic fundamentalists opposed to Pashtun nationalism, they are Islamic fundamentalists who are also Pashtun nationalists. So they may not ever espouse the brand of Pashtun nationalism of the sort that we saw under Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan, which was left-leaning, influenced by socialism, influenced by Gandhianism, and so on. That's not going to be the Taliban, but they could still end up mobilizing Pashtuns in a much more violent religious way for Sharia law. And in fact, you already see elements of that in groups like the TTP or the Pakistani Taliban, which has been battling the Pakistani military. So the Pashtun question in many ways, I think, has not been closed. It remains open. I'm not making any predictions of where it goes, but I think that that's a very big can of worms that that events in Afghanistan has opened. Finally, it comes the final point, and this is fairly obvious, is that Pakistan has its own problems with terrorism. Again, just as we've seen an uptick of violence in Indian-administered Kashmir, we're also seeing an uptick of violence in Pakistan after the fall of Kabul. The TTP has been stepping up attacks on the Pakistani military. They feel empowered. They are ideologically essentially twins of the Taliban in Afghanistan, albeit they are more focused on fighting the Pakistani army, and the Afghan Taliban have been proteges of the Pakistani army. But so in any case, so this has opened up, I think, the question of how Pakistan deals with domestic terrorism. I think that is, it has put that front and center also, and which is of course a subset of how it deals with some of these deeper currents in Islam in Pakistan and in the subcontinent. So I think I've spoken for about a little bit more than 20 minutes at this point. So why don't I leave it at this? And I'd love to sort of develop any more of these thoughts in our Q&A. Thank you.
Senator, thank you very much. So we come to questions and discussion. We're finished no later than the top of the hour. You got an email today, those on the call telling you how to get in, just use the hand function or give a wave if you're desperate. So many thanks for that very comprehensive analysis of India and Pakistan after the return of the Taliban. About the American exit from Afghanistan, I mean, looking at it from your position in Washington, from your background in and great knowledge of India, has this affected the way, the manner of the exit? Has this affected the way the United States or in general, or the Biden administration in particular, is regarded in places like India and Pakistan vis-a-vis China? Or is it just something that will be resolved once people move on from the topic, and or is it affected the way the United States is regarded?
Now, I don't know whether the effect is permanent, but I think there is no doubt that there has been an effect. There is no doubt that American credibility has taken a blow. There is no doubt that the manner of the withdrawal, the haphazard withdrawal, the fact that they ended up leaving so much material for the Taliban to take over, the fact that the withdrawal was essentially at the mercy of the Taliban, the terrible suicide bombing that took place at the airport, all of this has weakened. It has hurt America's image. It has made what should have been projected as a calm, confident withdrawal that would allow the US to focus more on China, which was the intention and which was the way the Biden administration has been trying to frame it. It has not successfully framed it in that way. And I think particularly in South Asia, the overwhelming sense, from reading the commentariat both in India and in Pakistan, has been that this was shambolic and it has diminished the US. I'm not sure how long that will last. I think that people's memories tend to be short, and many people have written off America in the past, and America has bounced back. I tend to be an optimist in the long term about the US. I think that we should not underestimate the US capacity to get its house in order and bounce back. But there is no doubt that, at least for now, this has been a clear setback.
Thanks for that. So we'll just before we move on to questions and just use the hand function, we'll go to Anthony in a minute. You mentioned China there, and as you know, you're in Washington and in DC a couple of weeks ago. I think the meeting of the Quad, Japan, India, Australia, United States, I think it was held in the White House. Prime Minister Modi went, our Prime Minister, the US President, the Japanese Prime Minister. What's your reflections on that?
So I was quite, pleasantly surprised to see that the Quad has, it has really come a long way in the past year. And if we were having this conversation even a year ago, the Quad was a grouping which half the time seemed to be too afraid even to use the term Quad in their readouts, or sometimes they wouldn't even have joint readouts. Everybody was walking on eggshells. Everybody was very concerned about how the Chinese would interpret this. And this is something that has changed in all four capitals, right? So we now see a realization that tiptoeing around Chinese sensibilities is not necessarily going to result in the Chinese being less aggressive, whether it's in the Himalayas with India, whether it's on the Senkakus with Japan, whether it's in terms of their 14-point demands with Australia and so on. So I think that reflection was reflected very clearly in the fact that this is a group that had never met even at the foreign minister level until a couple of years ago. Then earlier this year they met virtually at the leader level, and now they've met in person at the leader level. So the rather dramatic symbolic growth of the Quad since 2017, I think that is one thing that has been surprising. The other thing that is worth keeping an eye on is that there really seems to be an attempt to make this much more than a talk shop. And you see that in some of the language, for example, about technology. Now we have to see how they're able to in fact implement this. But if you read that joint statement, it is not so hard to imagine a future where you have these four countries along with perhaps like-minded partners in Europe that work, for example, to ensure that Huawei and ZTE are not the dominant players in 5G in the world, that work together to ensure that the democratic countries, places like Taiwan, the Netherlands, and the US, retain an edge in semiconductor technology to ensure that the Chinese do not become dominant in artificial intelligence. So what I thought was very interesting was that there seems to be a lot of thought going into finding ways in which these countries can cooperate practically. The first and the most high profile such venture, of course, was the vaccine initiative, which was derailed by the horrific Delta variant surge in India earlier this year. But that too, it looks like they want to put that back on track. And so I think this sort of search for practical ways in which the four countries can cooperate, particularly in Southeast Asia, I think really shows that those who believed that the Biden administration would not be as focused on China, would not care about the Quad, have really been proved wrong.
Okay, so we're going to go in order. We're going Anne and Anthony and Nick, and then we go on. So Anne?
This question may have partly been answered in the previous one, but I was interested in, now that America has abandoned Afghanistan and the sensitivities that it's unleashed and the problems with terrorism and their interest in India's part in countering China, does this change the way in which the United States will deal with India in terms of alliances or usefulness, whatever, in terms of the unsettling of that area? I mean, India is thinking more of its Western problems. America wants it to think more of its Pacific problems or its China problems, but this then puts the whole problem into a new ball game. Will the United States treat India differently from now on? It's got the problems with the border with China, India, and it's got the problems with terrorism in Pakistan.
I think what you're going to see is the Indians demanding and getting greater reassurances from Washington on their terrorism concerns, specifically to do with Pakistan. So, for example, I imagine that you're going to see continued pressure on Pakistan on things like FATF, the Financial Action Task Force. You're going to see continued scrutiny of, you're going to see continued pressure for them to ensure that some of this does not spill over. Whether that's successful or not is anybody's guess at this point, but I think that what India is going to ask for in return for its cooperation is that its concerns about terrorism are taken seriously and are not swept under the carpet. And that's what but a lot of this, what India can do, and I think I agree entirely with your premise, what India ends up doing is going to be determined to a very large degree by whether there is or is not dramatic blowback from Afghanistan. If you see a rash of terrorist attacks, if you see the security situation go south, then I think that India's attention is going to redouble. It's going to focus more and more on its land border and its problems with Pakistan, its problems in the region. If, however, there is a way to contain this through a combination of domestic measures and working with the international community, specifically the US and India, it does not end up experiencing that blowback, then I think what you're going to see is a continuation of a process that we've been seeing for a while, where India becomes more deeply embedded in its relationship with the US and also deepens its relationship with close American allies like Australia and Japan. And even though India is not ever going to be a formal treaty ally, it would somehow in de facto terms tilt quite obviously and markedly towards the Western alliance. I think if the terrorism issue is taken care of, we're going to see that trend continue. If the terrorism issue gets out of hand, then I think we may have to rethink.
So the last thing, if it gets out of hand, you may have to?
I think then you'd have to sort of India would probably relook at its priorities. I've already seen some commentators in India, including commentators close to the ruling party, argue that because the Americans have left Afghanistan, the Indians can't afford to ignore the Russians and the Chinese, because the Russians and the Chinese together are the ones who are going to be dominating the Eurasian landmass, and India would be foolish to alienate them. So you already are beginning to see some murmurings along those lines. But I think a lot of this is going to be driven by actual events and how they unfold.
Thank you. So go Anthony and then Nick.
Well, thank you. You've just introduced a question that I was about to ask yourself when you mentioned the Russians. To what extent now will the Russians become critical to Indian foreign policy? I noticed that after the fall of Afghanistan, the first people that contacted each other were not the Americans and the Indians, but the Indians and the Russians. So going to be the likely reaction to Russia? And the second one is...
We'll just take one. Okay. I'm just taking one. Okay, so it's about Russia.
So the Indian relationship with Russia is very interesting. So there is obviously a sort of, it's an old relationship that goes back to the Cold War. There is still among many Indians a certain amount of sentimentality towards the Russians. There is a sense in India that when it comes to certain high technology military items, things like nuclear submarines, much in the news in Australia, I know, the Russians are the ones who are willing to step up and supply India. So that's an old relationship, but Afghanistan has in many ways been testing it because the Russians have been quite friendly with the Taliban. The Russians have during this peace process at times kept India out of the loop. The Indian hope would be that if the Taliban remains hostile to India, which is likely, that they could cobble together some kind of anti-Taliban resistance the way they did in the 1990s, and that would necessarily include both Russia and Iran. There isn't that much evidence that this is in fact happening right now. And in many ways, I think it's the Russian position itself seems to be up in the air, where you had, on the one hand, you had the Russians in the lead up to August 15th, aiding the Taliban in the sense of leaning on some of their own proxies to surrender and so on. But my best understanding is that now that it's not clear which way Moscow's policy is going to go because their allies have not really been given too much. So if there is a rethink in Moscow, I think that there would be a lot of receptivity in India to that rethink. But for now, to the extent that the Russians are players in Afghanistan, India obviously wants to retain that relationship. But if you sort of step back from Afghanistan for a moment and take the broad view of India-Russia relations, it's certainly true that it remains an important relationship for India. It's not a relationship that India wants to let go of. But the two major reasons for that are not to do with Afghanistan. The first reason, of course, is the one I mentioned, which is arms sales. Even though India is less dependent on Russian arms today than it was during the Cold War, Russia still remains a major military supplier, along with America, France, Israel, and others. But Russia is still the dominant supplier. The second is that there is a widely held belief in Delhi, even today, that the Russians can, in fact, be weaned off of their dependence on the Chinese. And there's nothing that the Indians would like to see more than a kind of, you know, what they call the reverse Kissinger, the opposite of the Sino-Soviet split in reverse. My own view and the overwhelming view in Washington is that this is an unrealistic view of looking at Russia, that the Moscow and Beijing are in fact very, very closely enmeshed for a variety of reasons. But in India, there's still a feeling that Russia is still in play. And the fact that India buys a considerable amount of weaponry from Russia, in fact, helps Russia remain relatively independent because its military industrial base is not focused only on its own relatively minor needs and the Chinese needs. But the fact that they also supply India keeps Moscow as more of an independent actor. I think that argument is overstated, but that is how it is viewed over there.
Right, so go with Nick and then Shakira. Nick?
Thank you for your talk. In Southeast Asia, how do you see this the Taliban affecting Indonesia and the Muslim population, huge Muslim populations Australia has to its north?
So, you know, it's been a while since I have been in Indonesia. My book came out, you know, more than 10 years ago at this point. But I'll just say one thing historically, when I was reporting for Fanatic, one of the things that I was struck by repeatedly when I met with various Islamist figures across Indonesia was how many of them spoke to me about 1979 being a turning point for them. And the fact that when the Soviets moved in and the idea of jihad was revived. I remember spending time with the founder of Lashkar Jihad back in around 2000. They were shipping fighters over to Ambon to fight with Christians over there, people armed with machetes. I met another guy, one of the guys who was involved with FBI, which is one of these thuggish groups in Jakarta. Again, there was a sort of connection to Afghanistan. So the connection to Afghanistan was both real in terms of people who had actually physically gone and taken part in the jihad against the Soviets, but it was also symbolic. It was this idea that the Mujahideen defeated a superpower armed only with faith and with God's will. I fear that is going to be the lesson, that's going to be the takeaway that Islamist groups and militant groups across the world take. And there's absolutely no reason for us to believe that it's going to be any different in Indonesia or any different in the Philippines or any different in any part of the world. This is how they view it. And you're going to see a real boost of self-belief, self-confidence. It's a morale booster for them. And if I was in Australia, that's something that I would certainly be watching very closely.
Shakira?
I wanted to ask, there's been a lot of hope in Pakistan that CPAC will allow Pakistan to be less dependent on what's widely perceived as a vassal state relationship with the United States. How do you think the takeover of the Taliban and the departure of the United States, and the United States' renewed focus on China for that matter, how will that impact on CPAC or that strengthen processes that were already underway, do you think?
So I think the key challenge for Pakistan on CPAC really is domestic stability. Can Pakistan provide security to Chinese workers and engineers in Balochistan, in the parts of that CPAC goes through? So that's sort of one key question. The second question, of course, relates to opacity, corruption, that whole set of issues around CPAC. And the third is to what degree are these projects going to be economically viable? I personally do not think that, some people have argued that the Chinese are going to move into Afghanistan and CPAC is going to sort of, the Belt and Road is going to now kind of have a big place in Afghanistan too. And the Chinese are going to mine rare earths and other things from Afghanistan. My own sense is that this is much easier to say than to do. And as long as the security situation is volatile, it's going to be a challenge operationalizing CPAC in a meaningful manner. In terms of the American Pakistani dependence on America, I think that you've been seeing that in many ways that has been diminishing over the years. President Trump basically has already cut a great deal of American aid. There has been skepticism towards Pakistan developed, particularly after Osama bin Laden was found in Abbottabad, which is essentially, as also houses Pakistan's premier military academy. So I think the old days, right, or the not so old days of Kerry Lugo Berman, of the Americans believing that, you know, with the right amount of money and the right amount of policy attention, America could really alter the course of Pakistan, that it could work with the military to fight against the terrorists, but at the same time strengthen democracy, a free press, and give the Pakistani civilians the kind of ballast they needed to stand up a government that would be able to control the army. I think all those ambitions now, looking back from our vantage point in 2021, they look a bit pie in the sky. I think we've got a much more modest view of Pakistan now in Washington. There is a great deal of anger about the Pakistani role in abetting and aiding the Taliban for all these years. And so the, you know, the old joke about Pakistan that there are three A's, Allah, Army, and America, I think we should that should be revised, and there are only two A's that are still there, Allah and Army. I don't think America is looming as large in Pakistan as it used to, and I don't think there's even much of a desire for the US to try and play the kind of role that it had played for many decades in Pakistan.
Chin.
My question is very simple. How do you consider China's future role in this area, and how would India face off? Do you think China achieved some kind of victory in this round of Afghanistan showdown between Biden and Xi Jinping? Thank you.
I think it's a Chinese victory in the short term, only to the extent that it's a victory of Pakistan's. And Pakistan's enhanced influence in Afghanistan means enhanced Chinese influence. And again, this is nothing new. Many of you remember that the first or the only foreigner, or sort of the non-Muslim foreigner, Mullah Omar of the Taliban, is said to have met was the Chinese ambassador back when the Taliban ruled in the 1990s. So the Taliban, the Chinese certainly have more influence over a Taliban-ruled Afghanistan because of their very close relationship with Pakistan. So to that extent, I would say it's certainly the Chinese have won this hand. But beyond that, I'm not so sure, because they have there's going to be instability on their borders. I know that they are dealing with the Uyghurs in a particularly hard manner, but it's not clear to me that they would welcome a radical fundamentalist government on their borders. It's not clear to me how much the Taliban will in fact cooperate, or the Taliban has told the Chinese apparently that they will cooperate with groups like ETIM. It's not clear how that's going to work out in practice. And in the end, I think it's certainly beneficial to the Chinese or to Xi Jinping to see America humbled and humiliated. But it's not clear to me whether in the long term, a chaotic Afghanistan or an Afghanistan under the rule of the Taliban is a great strategic prize for China.
Glenn.
Thanks, Jared. Thank you for your insights. My question is quite simple too. Given that the Taliban now have to govern, and they have their own security issues with ISIS on the ground, realistically, what is their capacity to project outwards in the region?
So they don't need to have capacity to project outwards in the region. It's not as though in the late 1990s, the Taliban were, you know, jumping into the cockpits of fighter planes or jumping into tanks. Afghanistan was a problem because of what the Taliban allowed others to do on Afghan soil. That was the problem. It wasn't power projection by the Taliban. And I think that is the worry again. The worry is not that the Taliban themselves are going to attack the Indian army in Kashmir. The worry is that groups like the Jaish-e-Mohammed, groups like the Lashkar-e-Taiba, other groups are going to use Afghanistan as a place to train, that the ISI might use Afghan soil as a means to gain plausible deniability for some of these groups, that various sort of freelance terrorists and militants will be attracted to this place as a kind of grand experiment to implement God's law on earth. And then that they will go back to their home countries, whether it's Indonesia or Tunisia or anywhere else, inflamed by these ideas the way they had been in the 1980s and 1990s. So it's much less about, you know, the Taliban, what the Taliban does. It's much more about the conditions that the Taliban fosters and the power of their idea for people who are inclined towards militancy and terrorism.
So we're getting close to the end. So I don't think I've missed anyone, Anne. Second last question.
I just wanted to go back to this Afghanistan thing. How strong is the hold of the Taliban in actually keeping Afghanistan? There seem to be a lot of ratbags bombing Kabul airport, whatever. And the place seems to be running out of money. It seems to be almost going towards a failed state. How strong will the Taliban be as the rulers of Afghanistan going forward?
So I think there are two sort of separate questions hidden in there. I mean, the one question is, to what degree does the Taliban control the territory of Afghanistan? And the second is, what kind of governance can we expect from them? I think the second is probably easier to answer. We're not going to expect good governance from the Taliban, right? I don't think we're going to have the world's best central bank governor. I don't think you're going to see the most, innovative use of monetary policy. It's the question on governance and on Taliban, frankly, is the debate is how much less brutal are they going to be than Taliban 1.0? And you have one group of people who say that because Afghanistan has changed dramatically over the past 20 years, because the Taliban themselves have been exposed by travel to places like Doha, they have become more technologically savvy. They all have smartphones. They know how to use Instagram and so on. That Taliban 2.0 is going to be kinder and gentler. I am quite skeptical of this view. I think that the ideological roots of the Taliban's particular interpretation of Islam run deep. And you already see that girls are out of school. You already have musicians cowering in terror. You already have war crimes against the Hazara Shia. So in terms of governance, I don't think we should hold our breath and expect much. In terms of control, that's a more interesting question. It seems like, if you compare this with the 1990s, in many ways, the Taliban are in a stronger position today than they were then, simply because back then, on 9/11, for instance, about 10% of the country was not in their control, including areas that were bordering Tajikistan. If you look at their situation right now, they captured the border outposts first. They controlled the country. A handful of people who had gone to the Panjshir Valley, which was a holdout and was notoriously a very difficult place to capture militarily. Even the Soviets had struggled. The Panjshir Valley is at least the main valley, maybe not some of the side valleys, but the main valley is now controlled by the Taliban. So militarily, they're in a strong position. The one question mark is how much damage can ISIS-K do to them? And it's certainly true that we see bombings and other attacks, but it's not clear to me whether ISIS-K is enough, is able to do more than carry out suicide bombings and so on. I don't know if they're able to actually challenge the Taliban in terms of control of territory. So in many ways, I would say that the Taliban in 2021 is stronger than the Taliban was towards the end of their rule 20 years ago. But we shouldn't expect too much by way of governance.
Final question, John.
It used to be said of the Australia-India relationship about three C's: Commonwealth, curries, and cricket. In view of what's happened in the cricket world since the fall of Afghanistan, of Kabul, I'm interested in your thoughts when now we've got a situation where most likely England will not tour Pakistan, which was obviously being very much looked forward to, and most likely Australia will not play a test match against Afghanistan, which is also very much looked forward to. Does this have any significance at all in the minds of the Taliban?
So on the cricket question, I in fact think the Australians are making a mistake. And it again goes back to the old schism between Aligarh and Deoband. No one is hurting the Taliban by not playing cricket with Afghanistan. You are hurting the elements of Afghan society that the Taliban mistrust. And in fact, that the Taliban were willing to allow cricket this time round when they weren't last time round, in fact, shows that that was something that they would have had to sort of hold their nose and put up with it. So in a way, I think the well-meaning people who are recommending this boycott are in fact doing the Taliban's work for them. So it's really tragic, and I wish someone would that would be reversed. In terms of Pakistan, I think the Pakistanis are very upset that England have canceled their tour. And I think it's sort of, you know, direct blowback. It's an unstable part of the world. I don't have, you know, as strong a view on that one way or the other. But in the long term, what I would, you know, like to see happen is obviously see greater stability in both countries and have both countries play cricket. And then I think it's very sad if you're a lover of the sport, as I am, to sort of see the politics, you know, really front and center and take over and not allow cricketers to just, you know, play the game and be, you know, be innocent of some of this stuff.
In about a minute we've got left, before I say thank you, can you give us a preview of your next book about India under the BJP and Mr. Modi?
Yeah, so Gerard, I've been working on this for a while, and just by way of quick background, you know, when Modi rose to power in 2013 and 2014, I was certainly one of those who saw the glass as half full. And in a nutshell, I thought that Modi would be able to modernize the economy, and I thought he would keep in check some of the more radical elements in his movement and his party who are deeply hostile to religious minorities, particularly to Muslims, but also to Christians. Unfortunately, and this is something that I raise in the book, in many ways I got it exactly wrong. He had ended up doing not very much on the economy. Though over the past year he has done, you know, more than he did in his first term, but he hasn't ended up being the kind of Thatcherite figure who would bring free market vigor to India. And at the same time, on the social front, he has ended up empowering some extremely ugly elements within his party and his movement. And it raises a fundamental question about the future of Indian democracy. I think no one doubts whether that India will remain an electoral democracy where people elect their leaders, but I think that this has raised serious questions about whether India will remain a liberal democracy in the sense of one where there's equality before the law and where there are independent institutions such as the media and independent journalism that checks government power.
Well, many thanks for the preview. We await the book. So look, thanks for being so generous with your time today. We've ranged across a whole range of issues from India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, China, Russia, and beyond. So we're very grateful. I read you every fortnight in the Wall Street Journal, Anne does as well, and we follow your work, and we'd love to have you back here again. But for tonight, your time, and for midday, our time, we're very grateful. Many thanks and good luck.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.